Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Ally. Ally, powered by Verizon locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company. In collaboration with Ally, a membership-only community workspace for creators. Each location is a community curated powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Ally, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems for entrepreneurs.
And now, on to my interview with Michael Dorit.
I think you have to have a passion for what you're doing. You can't just say, I think I like that job. It looks like I could make a lot of money. Because, yeah, I think you have to put that out of your head if you're serious about being an artist of some kind.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music, let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study their moves, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
Welcome to the Silent Giants Podcast, a podcast that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. To keep up with the latest on the show, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Silent Giants Podcast. To keep up with my life, music, and more, be sure to follow me as well at Corey Cambridge. Today's special guest is graphic designer Michael Dorit, the silent giant behind that famous New York Knicks logo. In this interview, I sit down with Michael to chat about his upbringing in Brooklyn, how he got into graphic design. He offers young advice to creatives. We talk about the sacrifices he's made along the way. And of course, we go into that iconic New York Knicks logo. Without further ado, let me introduce you to the graphic designer, my friend, the silent giant, Michael Dorit.
Put that out?
No, I'm going to keep it in there. All your sniffles.
My sniffling and my...
Michael, how are you, man?
I'm good. Thanks for inviting me here, Corey.
You're a smooth dude. Very dapper guy.
Oh, well, that's all Laura, my wife.
Laura, you did a great job.
She's my dresser. She's my stylist.
Yeah, you know, I didn't have any impression of you upon today. So to see you, you have like that Sean Connery vibe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a quote from Sean Connery. I can't think of one.
Like my mom would think you're cute.
My name is Bond.
Yeah, there you go.
James Bond.
You got swag. Like, I like the frames, like the outfit.
Laura's like going, oh no, he's getting really corny.
Corny's in right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Welcome back to New York, man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back. I get back maybe hopefully once a year, or if not more.
Okay. Do you miss it? You live out in LA now. So
I do. Well, I'm not going to get into the comparing LA to New York.
Yeah.
Thing,
yeah. I mean, there's no comparison.
Because they're completely different animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's, you know, when I'm in LA, I love it there. When I'm back here, you know, I love it. Although, you know, you should ask me again after another week here. We were just kind of bucking all the rush hour crowds and, you know, bumping into people and so on. And that never happens in L.A.
Right. No, I enjoy my time out there. It's very relaxing. It's very calm.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that.
When we first moved out, I felt like I was on vacation all the time, even when I was working, because it was just the weather, the, you know, just the everything was so laid back.
Oh, where do you live in L.A.?
We recently moved to Pasadena.
Okay. Where is that in terms of like the city of the suburb sprawl of LA? I don't know where that is.
You know, west of after I've lived there for 25 years, I still don't know all the areas. People mention all these, you know, names to me and I don't know where they are, but we went to the right to the hub when we first came at, right to the hub when we first came out. We lived in Hollywood.
Okay.
And a little bit right near the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay, yeah.
Which was,
I was just out there. Beautiful area.
Yeah, which was perfect because, you know, we could just walk to the bowl.
Yeah.
From where, from our house. But our house was an old 1930s Mediterranean style house, and it was just it became like a money pit for us. It just everything was breaking. The maintenance, it was just too much, and we really had to sell because, you know, as we're getting older, our incomes are not what they once were, and I don't have all that extra cash to throw into the house all the time. So we sold and we moved to Pasadena into a condo.
Okay.
And where we don't have to worry about all the maintenance. And
no maintenance, nice weather.
Yeah.
Life is good.
Yeah.
Are you born and raised in New York? Are you
I'm born in born here in Manhattan. Lived grew up in Brooklyn.
Oh, where about?
Sheepshead Bay.
Oh, that's like true blue Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's typically where, like, I live in Bed-Stuy.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the neighborhoods that are kind of closer to Manhattan are super gentrified and transplant New Yorkers. But if I meet someone from like Sheepshead Bay or Bay Ridge, it's,
well,
true blue.
Well, that's now. But, you know, like there was no Williamsburg or, you know, Bushwick. That they were all just neighborhoods where, you know, people were living and no hipsters or anything like that.
What was the vibe like? What around what time period did you grow up in?
I grew up in the 50s.
Okay.
In Brooklyn. And my area, you were either Jewish or Italian. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, and it really kind of amounted to the same thing. You know, all my friends were either Jewish or Italian.
Do you remember anything about Ebbets Field?
Okay. So my parents were a little bit snobbish about things. They were really into classical music and so on, and not into sports or anything. So they never took me to Ebbets Field. My friend, my best friend's dad took me. And I remember I was there twice.
Okay.
Yeah, I was there twice.
What was it like?
Well, that was like another lifetime. It's hard to remember, really. I mean, if I said anything, I'd be making it up. But all I know is I was there. I saw the Dodgers. You know, the Dodgers were like so pervasive of everything in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And I still kind of hold it against them that they moved. Growing up in Brooklyn at that time, I tell this story a lot, that I grew up near Coney Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my friends and I would bike over there a lot. And when you're there, you're surrounded by all, at that time, it was like incredible banners and signage and colors and the sounds, the smells. And I would just fixate on all these things. And they burned themselves into my head, especially all the visual things and, you know, the lettering and all that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the beginning of when I just started to be much more aware of that stuff. My dad worked in Times Square. He worked for MGM, the movie company. And I would, you know, sometimes after school, I would take the train into the city and I'd get off at Times Square and you come out into Times Square. And it was very different from what it is now, but it was just as incredible to see all the incredible billboards. And there was Mr. Peanut in a full Peanut costume walking around outside the Planters Peanut store and all the signage. And it was just like a wonderland. And I would just be like, you know, going crazy looking at all this stuff. And it like Coney Island, it all burned into my brain. And so I really became fascinated on a subconscious level with lettering and letter forms and signage and all that.
At what point did you realize that you could do this as a profession?
I didn't really until I was in college. I went to Cooper Union, and I had a, but before that in high school, I had a great teacher who really encouraged me to go to Cooper Union and to develop my art. And I thought I was going to be a fine artist when I went there, but I soon realized that I was much better at solving problems.
Were your parents very supportive of you becoming an artist and getting into the creative world?
It was funny because I thought they were, and they were to me, but my my art teacher at high school, who I befriended later on in life, I went back and found him, and we really kind of became friends. He told me, I mean, this was after my parents had passed away, that he had to convince them, because they wanted me to go to law school, and I don't even remember them even talking about that fact. But he convinced them that I should go to Cooper Union for art. And the thing that really convinced them was that he told them it was free.
Sold.
So I went to Cooper Union. I thought maybe I'd be a painter or a sculptor because I knew I loved to draw. I hadn't put all this together in my head about all these things that were floating in there from when I was a kid, all the signs and lettering and all that. So as I went through Cooper Union, I realized I'm not going to be a painter. When I'm faced with a blank canvas, nothing comes into my head. But I was very good at solving communication problems. I realized that I'm going to end up in commercial art because I can make a living there. I don't know what I would do in with fine art. So then I took, they didn't have too many, in the day school, they didn't have too many graphic design classes. So I ended up taking them at night. And that really sold me that I knew this was the direction I needed to go in. Mm. And so that was where it started.
You know, I always tell, for me, I come from a musical background as an artist and as a rapper. And so being a fine artist is almost kind of like being a rapper in terms of you're not really solving a problem with your art. It can almost be sometimes self-loathing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you can use your talent to help other people, you'll always find a place. You know, if you find that to be true?
Well, what I do, I don't know if that it helps other people so much as just...
Totally it does. For music, right? Like the cover, the design. That's the first thing that you see.
Well, right.
You know?
But it isn't so I'm not like a humanitarian that I'm my work is going to, uplift, the people. It's really commercial art, and I'm doing it for money, and I'm doing it usually for corporations or for companies. So it helps them. And people, I do know that people love, I mean, I get fan mail. I know that my work on some level touches people.
Yeah, totally.
And that's actually almost more valuable to me than getting the paycheck, to know that, like, because being a commercial artist, I've never given up on the idea that I have a vision, and I know these people want me to solve their problem, but for me, the best way to do it is for me to be able to impose my vision and still solve their problem.
And I think no matter whether it's music, whether it's graphic design, that, or whether it's fine art, good art always strikes emotion.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Realness That's will true. Always... pierce through. When you got out of Cooper's Union, what was your first opportunity professionally?
I'm trying to remember now. The very first, my first job out of Cooper was, it was very telling because it was almost like it almost happened on purpose, but it didn't. It was like I got a job in this place called Photo Lettering. And that was in Midtown, and it was we don't have typesetting houses anymore.
What is a typesetting house?
Okay, on your laptop or on your computer, you can access all kinds of fonts.
Yeah.
Before computers, that didn't exist.
Wow.
Say you were doing a book cover and you needed typeset for the cover.
Yeah.
You had sample books of different type styles. And you would have to, like, then call up a type house and send them like either a manuscript or a sheet of paper with everything written out, what you want, what size, which font, and so on. Then you get proofs back. It was a very involved process.
Wow.
And so photo letter, and usually it had been, historically, it had all been done out of lead type. So, you know, like, or wood type even. So you would have to set the type in metal. You ink it, and then you run it through a press, and you get a nice impression on paper of the type. And that was what you would reproduce from.
Was there like a popular house? What was it called again? Letter printing house?
A type house.
Was there like a popular one?
Oh, there were hundreds. There were hundreds.
But they were like Kinko's or something, like that type of.
Well, not exactly, but they were okay. they were in Manhattan. They were everywhere.
Okay.
There were hundreds of them.
Okay.
And then photo lettering came along, and photo lettering was a photo that their fonts were not on metal; they were on negative film. And they would be able to, it was a much easier and cleaner way of setting type. And my first job there, well, my mother knew somebody who worked, who had a connection or something, and got me an interview with this guy named Ed Bengat. And I didn't know it, but Ed Bengat was like an historical figure in the type community. And I became his assistant. And I learned just about everything I know about lettering from him, and the very first job I got out of Cooper. But that job was really going to go nowhere. So I left there, and then I had a series of other staff jobs, culminating in my working in the promotion art department for Vogue and Butterick patterns. Mm. You know, the patterns that maybe your mom would use to sew dresses or create dresses.
You okay. know? What did you learn from Ed?
I learned everything about how to, you know, because I wasn't really into lettering, but you know how in life you go you go down certain roads, and you come to a crossroads, and you make a turn, and then you come to another one, you make another turn, and that's the path of your life. And going to that job somehow reached back into my past, where my fascination with all the signage and lettering and banners from Coney Island and Times Square. And so I really liked it. And I thought that I can do something with this in my life.
What's important advice you would give to a young person breaking into their career that you learned?
Well, first, I think you need to, if you want to be in the arts, I think you have to have a passion for what you're doing. You can't just say, I think I like that job. It looks like I could make a lot of money. Because yeah, I think you have to put that out of your head and just, if you're serious about being an artist of some kind. Because if you're good, hopefully that will follow. But you have to have the passion for what it is you're doing. That would be my first advice. And then know the history of what you're doing. You know, I've ran into so many musicians that don't know the history of, you know, music. You know, you can look anything up on the internet, the history of graphic design or the history of music or classical music. There's just such a wealth of material there to be tapped into. And I think it's just laziness that if you don't.
Well, who was your, kind of your first big client?
Well, when I, I worked at Butterick, Vogue and Butterick. And then I didn't find it satisfying enough. So I started taking on freelance work at night. And taking it home to work on, so I would be working, you know, day and night. And at one point, I went to, so I was taking my portfolio around. That's what you do when you're a graphic artist or an illustrator. You figure out who are the clients that I want to work for. You call them up and ask, can I bring my portfolio and show you? Portfolio is a book of things that you have that you're proud of, that you want to impress people with. So I took my portfolio at the recommendation of at one of these. Sometimes you don't get work. Sometimes you just get referrals or recommendations. Oh, you should go see so-and-so. And I went to see this illustrator named Charles White III. He said, you have to just quit your job and start freelancing, and I'll give you a desk here. And he also kind of started giving me some work to help him with his illustrations. And some of them were for pretty big clients. And so I got an inside track on how the business worked. How do you deal with clients? And also,
how do you deal with clients? Like, what's important in, as far as dealing with a client?
Oh, that's like a whole interview.
So, and like really quick bullet form of
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
What are some important things in your world of graphic design that is important, how to communicate with a client?
Well, you have, first of all, you have to like ask a lot of questions about okay. I always ask why did you pick me? Or what is it you want to communicate? Or what do you like? Show me examples of the things you like and that you gravitate towards, and maybe it'll give me a clue as to why you think I can do this. And but you also have to deal with there's politics, there's the whole money aspect, which most people in my profession prefer not to even deal with, because they just want to do the work that they'll do it for free, and when you're starting out, sometimes you do pretty much, for a lot of low paying work. But, you have to keep you can't forget about the money, because that's why you you need to live.
Yeah.
And you have to realize that your work has a certain value, and you can't undersell it. There's a whole organization called the Graphic Artists Guild that has come up that is formed around the idea of protecting artists in all these types of situations and helping them navigate the world of dealing with clients. Mm. It's very complicated, because you're never in the same situation twice. You can say, oh, I learned my lesson in this one, but the next time something comes up, it's completely different, and you're back at square one and how to deal with it.
How did the opportunity for you to do the Knicks logo, like, how did that come about?
At that point, I think that was around 19, it was the late 80s. Yeah. And I was really feeling like my career is really starting to move. And like, people knew about me, they knew about my work in the field. And I just got a call from the NBA to come in. They wanted to talk to me about some projects, and it was nothing complicated about that. I'm so sure I'll be right there.
What were some of the? They didn't say like what specifically the projects were. They just come in and
yeah, we want to talk to you about some work, and. So I go in and I can't remember if the Knicks was the very first. I think there might have been some other smaller projects that came up. No, the Knicks actually was the very first thing I did for them. And it was a project that took many months, you know, from start to finish.
Why did the Knicks have to go through a rebrand of any type? Who makes that call for the team to say, like, oh, we're going to go through a rebrand? Is it the team? Is it the NBA?
No, it wasn't the team. It was the NBA. And my belief, even to this day, is that the reason they started doing that, and they hadn't been doing it much when I started, was for merchandise. Because they needed better marks for their merchandise.
Okay. You mean like higher sales?
No, they needed better graphics.
Okay. Okay.
For all their merchandise, for all the teams, because they had really crappy logos.
And like, what were they looking for? Like, what was your first approach with that? Because it's also a very big. It's not, you know, I mean, no offense to the, you know, Memphis Grizzlies. It's also New York City. It's the biggest city in the world. It's the basketball mecca. Like, so what was the challenge or what questions did you ask going into making that logo?
Well, like what I was saying before, I wanted to know, well, what did you see in my work? And what is it that you want to, what is it you want to say with this, you know, this new logo? How do you want it to be different from what you already have?
What were their answers to that, to those questions?
Well, they said, well, it's ironic because what we ended up with was very similar in a lot of ways to what they had. I don't know if you're aware of what the previous logo
was. It the arch with the
it had the
basketball on the arch.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because they told me we want something completely new, and the big thing that they wanted me to do was to insert the Empire State Building somehow into the logo.
Okay.
Which I did many iterations or sketches. With showing how they could do that, and with the Empire State Building, and maybe without it, just other designs, and you know, this was a lot of back and forth over several months, showing different ideas. You know, can you try this? Can you try that? And in the end, they decided to take out the Empire State Building. Because I think it had something to do with they didn't want to have to pay royalties to whoever owned the rights to that.
Maybe, was it Trump? Did Trump ever own the Empire State Building?
No. Thank God.
Yeah, thank God. but who was the person you were corresponding with? Is this the team? Is this a league official?
It was a guy in the NBA, a creative director.
Okay. So when a team goes through a rebrand, a creative director of the league is in charge of the rebrand.
I don't know. It may not work that way anymore.
Okay.
I don't know how it works now because it's been so long. But at that point, the NBA was the kind of overarching organization for that. And all these teams were subordinate. And they were in charge of, you know, doing this for the teams.
At what point in the process did you come up with the design that we know of today?
It was, I guess, in the middle, but you know, we were looking at other designs, and then we eventually came back, and that design did have an Empire State Building in it, coming out through the top, and the words New York kind of went over the building. It kind of went up in kind of perspective, as if you were standing kind of underneath the Empire State Building, kind of following the perspective of the way the logo has a certain perspective.
Yeah.
But they decided to take it out.
What was the moment where they selected the final image that we know of today? Do you know the story behind that? Getting the confirmation of this is what it's going to be?
There wasn't any big story. They just went in one day and they said, this is the one. Just go to finish. Do the finished art.
Oh, so what does that mean? Do the finished art? Like do the...
Okay. So
I'm sorry.
So I prepare, you know, I start out very much like an illustrator works with, I do rough ideas in pencil form, very rough pencil. It's kind of scribbly. And then from there, I usually don't show those to a client because I'm just doing that for myself. And I do a ton of them. And then I kind of, at some point, I'll look through all those rough sketches and I just put little check marks to ones that I think might have some potential to be developed further. And then, so that I do that, and those are the ones, they're still pencil, just black pencil on tracing paper. I'll tighten them up a bit to the point where I think these guys will understand where I'm going if I show them at this point. So I go in and I bring those roughs. There may be a dozen or 10 or something like that. And then we discuss that. And you know, exactly what you might think. Then we go to a tighter stage after that, which is slightly tighter drawings and maybe with an indication of how I want the color. I may be doing 5 of those. And then I'm indicating color. And now I would do it on the computer and it would look perfect and slick and everything. But then I use colored pencils. I mean, there was just nothing that sophisticated about it. It was just I would just color it in the way I thought. I had some, you know, they weren't just the kind of colored pencils you buy at the at Rite Aid or something. They, you know, you go to an art store and I had a set of probably over 100 pencils, different permutations of the colors, and then that's kind of getting towards the end of the process, and then they kind of have to make their final selection.
Okay.
From there, or then maybe we may go back for another round.
Okay,
it just depends.
When they made the selection, do you remember the first time seeing that logo anywhere, like on a uniform or on a billboard?
Well, as far as that experience is concerned, I can talk. I don't really remember the exact first time I saw it, but I remember the first time I saw anything that I did like that, that was all of a sudden was everywhere. And that was, I worked with an illustrator on the Yellow Pages. Do you remember the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
He did a Yellow Pages cover and he hired me to do the words Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and so on. A different one for each of the 5 boroughs. And I just remember it was just so amazing when all of a sudden they came out, you know, they were just like everywhere. And you know, and that's when, you know, you could go in on the street, a phone booth, and you'd pull up the phone book and there it was, or into a luncheonette or whatever. And it was just everywhere. And I was like, amazing, you know.
What is that like to, you know, like I was walking through the streets today and you see everyone wearing that logo, like the New York Knicks. It's the mecca of basketball. I mean,
it's not
just the team, it's the mecca of the sport.
Yeah.
You know, so what does it feel to, you know, come back from LA and walk through the streets and you see people with that logo on? How does that make you feel?
Well, I've kind of gotten used to it, but I always think, I can't believe they're still using that after... after, let's see, 90. After.
Is it 88?
20, 20, no. Yeah, 28 years.
Wow.
28 years. And I think they're just going to keep that forever. I hope they do. But, you know, I'm always surprised that they still have it. You know, and it makes me feel good.
Yeah, because, you know, New York City to me is the greatest city in the world. And I love New York. So. To think that your logo is up there with the Yankee logo, or you know, even like the maple leaf for the parks.
Yeah,
you know, is just that recognizable with the city?
Yeah,
you know, and we touched on this earlier in the interview about, you know, it's not always about the money. It's about, you know, it's almost like you're always living, you're always breathing. Like great art lives on way beyond us.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like. Yeah. No, it's definitely a thrill, and I've had a few things like that in my career, and always wondering, will there be another?
always. You know, before we get out of here, I ask this question to every person who's been on the podcast, because I think every person that I've interviewed has achieved a level of greatness and embodies greatness inside of them. And I think our listeners also want to be great. and everyone wants it. It's on this pursuit of greatness.
But you can't have that. My thinking is that you can't have that as a goal. You can't like go into acting saying, I want to be a star. You go into acting because you love acting. And then if you become a star, you know, you just be the best that you can be. Mm. You know, I don't think that's a good goal, though, to say, I want to be famous.
Well, famous is different than great.
Okay.
Do you agree?
Yeah.
I feel like greatness is something that...
Well, usually they go hand in hand.
It's internal for me. Fame is outside.
Right.
Gratification. But okay. I want to always want to look at my work. I want to look, you know, look back at this interview and say, I gave a great interview. I don't care if 10 people heard it. I gave a great interview, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in order to be great, it comes with sacrifice. And I think that's, you have to balance in your life, you know, to be great at, for Michael Jordan to be great at basketball, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day. It means that you weren't great at something else.
Mm. Right.
What have you sacrificed to be great in your profession?
Well, you could ask my...
Laura, what do you think?
I ended up working all the time, you know, and to the exclusion probably of having a richer life while we were living in New York here. I was just always working. And I felt like I always felt like I had to be doing that. And I had this compulsion. And only now I'm kind of letting up a little bit on that. I think, you know, the thing is I love what I do. So it doesn't feel like a sacrifice when I'm working all the time. But I guess that the people around me may not be as thrilled about it. And I think the sacrifice is somewhere in there, if you follow me.
Because you know what? I had the opportunity to interview Susan Rogers. She recorded Prince's Purple Rain album. And she was talking about her background and what propelled her to be great. And she was saying that there were things that have to drive you. There has to be something that drives you. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's fear of not wanting to go back to where you were if you grew up in poverty. For her, she told the story of being in an abusive relationship. And that abusive relationship with her ex-husband drove her to just never want to go back. And she just kept moving forward. Like, what drives you?
Well, I think initially what drove me was I wanted my parents to be proud of me, you know, and that was huge for me. And because I was always, you know, my brother was more like the bad boy and he just kind of did whatever he wanted. But I was always trying to please them. And I remember a story about I did quite a few Time covers for Time that were, you know, more like illustrated covers. And I remember when I would just so want my parents, my father, to be, you know, proud of me. And I'd call them up and say, Mom, Dad, I just did a Time cover. It's going to be on the newsstands on Monday or whatever. And they'd go, oh, we'll make it to the store on Wednesday. And then I'd hear my father saying, well, this is good, but this is not your best work. You know, and like, it's like, what do I have to do to, yeah. you know, to get them to be, I know they were proud of me, but like, it was hard to hear things like that.
Yeah. You know, no matter, you know, how young we, you know, how young or old we are, we still have that little kid in us. There's a point in our lives where we still are little kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I still feel that. But my parents are gone, but I'm, you know, maybe they're proud of me up there.
For sure they are. Michael, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for just coming through and talking with me for a little bit. You're the man. I really appreciate this.
It's been a pleasure.
You're an inspirational guy.
Thank you.
We out of here.
Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of the Silent Giants podcast and to our special guest, Michael Dorrit. You can find Michael on social media by finding the links in the description of this bio. This episode was mixed by Mark Bird. And before we get out of here, be sure to check out my other podcast, OPP, Other People's Podcast, which highlights my favorite podcasters and the dope shows they created. I have the link to that in the description of this episode as well. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge, signing off. Till next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.